So in talking about the three principal aspects of the path, we were talking about renunciation or the determination to be free, and that that has two aspects to it. First, eliminating the clinging to this life, and then eliminating the clinging to future lives, to any kind of happiness and cyclic existence. So we finished talking about how to eliminate the clinging to this life. Remember, clinging to this life is attachment to the happiness of only this life, as exemplified by the eight worldly concerns and all of their marvelous manifestations that we practice so diligently and with great conscientiousness and perfection. And that the methods to do this is, as Jay Rinpoche says in the Three Principles of the Path, are remembering the freedoms and fortunes, our leisure and endowments of our precious human life, and then remembering the fact that we're going to die, our mortality. Okay, so that meditation on death that we've talked about for a couple of times, it's a very, very important one, and I think it makes a huge difference if we remember death every day, you know, because it makes our life really vital, really, we really appreciate our life, we really live it, we don't just kind of coast along and live on automatic. And we also get more of a sense of purpose in our life. Okay, so we're going to move on now to the second sentence in the fourth verse. By repeatedly contemplating the infallible effects of karma and the miseries of cyclic existence, reverse the clinging to future lives. Okay, so the two ways to generate renunciation for all of cyclic existence, including happy rebirths, is by remembering karma and by remembering the faults of cyclic existence. Okay, so I thought to talk about karma today. And there's a lot of interesting stuff in the topic about karma. So I don't want to make it too detailed. I thought, you know, as I was preparing for the class, I thought, well, could spend, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 sessions on karma. And I thought, no, maybe it's better, you know, we have a special course sometime just about karma and hit on some highlights this time. But you know me, how I get distracted and never finish stuff on time. We'll see how far we get. So actually observing karma is the core of the whole path. You know, the foundation of the whole path. It's the first thing we have to do. Without doing this, there's no way to build on and get higher realizations. And I think this is incredibly important because the whole talk of karma, you know, is speaking about ethical discipline and really getting our life together. And as you've probably heard me mention so often, some people come to the Dharma and want very high, fantastic practices and experiences, but don't want to change their ordinary habits on a day-to-day basis that create harm for themselves and others. Whereas, you know, what the Buddha really advised us to do is the foundation of our practice is to get our daily life together. And so the teachings on karma really go into that in great depth. And I personally find them very interesting because when you apply the teachings on karma, you know, to our own actions, then kind of what we do on a day-to-day life basis takes on a whole new significance, and it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's four general characteristics of karma that are helpful to understand. Before we get into them, remember karma means action, okay? And it means actions that we do physically or mentally or verbally. And in particular, volitional actions. In other words, actions done with some kind of intention. The word karma is often used also for actions that are done accidentally without any intention. Some karma is created with those. But really, when we're talking about karma, it's the karma that brings full results, you know, in terms of where we're reborn as and the other three results, that then we're talking about volitional actions, you know, with a definite motivation. Okay, so karma isn't anything magical or mysterious. It's actions, and those actions bring effects. So it's talking about cause and effect. Scientists talk about cause and effect in terms of physical properties, and Buddhists talk about cause and effect in terms of actions and their results. So this is more on a mental level, so to speak. And I should say karma also means, sometimes the way karma is used nowadays, it means I don't know. Okay? Like, why did this happen? Well, it's his karma. In other words, I don't know. Okay? So often we use the word karma in a very flippant way when we can't explain something. We just say, oh, it's karma. It's their karma. You know? But I think that's really flippant. It's not really, you know, considering the fact that anything that occurs had prior causes and conditioning. You know? And to think about those causes and conditions and, you know, that come together to cause a certain event. Okay, and not use karma in a flippant way, like, oh, I don't know why that happened, is karma, meaning, you know, kind of like magic. Okay, and I say this because once a word appears in Time magazine, then you know you have to start defining it more accurately. Yeah. Okay, so the four general qualities of karma. First of all, karma is definite. In other words, happiness comes from positive actions, unhappiness comes from negative actions. Now, this first one I find very, very interesting, because Buddha did not make up this law of karma. Buddha did not say, these are positive actions and you're going to get rewarded for doing them, and these are negative actions and you're going to get punished for doing them. Buddha didn't say it that way, and he didn't make up the cause and effect like this. Okay, Buddha only described it. And the way he did that is first he looked at the effects. Okay, because if you see the Buddhas having, you know, great insights and clairvoyant powers due to the, you know, elimination of defilements on his mind stream, then he looked, and whenever sentient beings, he saw sentient beings experiencing happiness, and he was able to see what actions caused that happiness. Those actions, you know, the karmic actions, were called positive. They were labeled positive because the result was happiness. When he looked at sentient beings' sufferings, the actions and the actions that caused them, those actions were named negative or destructive. That's the label given to them because they brought unhappiness. So I think this is important to remember. You know, that something is not positive or negative, virtuous or non-virtuous, inherently in and of itself because God or Buddha or somebody said so. Okay? So nothing's positive or negative by its own nature, independent of everything else in the universe. But something becomes labeled positive because it brings the result of happiness, and labeled negative or destructive because it brings the result of suffering. Okay, so this gives a totally different flavor to the talk of cause and result than you get in some theistic religions where a supreme being, you know, invented the cause and effect and dishes out the rewards and punishments. Because in Buddhism, there's no rewards and punishments, okay? Things just bring results. And again, this is important to remember. I've seen some Buddhist texts that have been translated by people who use Christian vocabulary. And I remember, in fact, once reading a translation of the Medicine Buddha Sutra, and it talking about, you know, people getting punished for this and that. And I realized, you know, this gives totally the wrong meaning. it's a wrong, it's a translation done by somebody who used Christian vocabulary who didn't understand the Buddhist meaning. Because there's no rewards and punishments in Buddhism. There's just results. Okay? And the results correspond to their causes. Now, if you plant carnation seeds, you get carnations. You don't get roses. If you plant rose seeds, you get roses. You don't get carnations or chilies. Okay? So things correspond to their result, but they aren't rewards or punishments. Things correspond to
rose seeds, you usually don't get anything. You don't grow very good in seeds.
Okay, where was I?
Cabbage seeds.
But to really remember that we aren't rewarded or punished, we just experience results. And I think psychologically that's a very important thing to remember. And especially to remember that the Buddha, is not a supreme being dishing out rewards and punishments. Okay, Buddha just described this system. Because if the Buddha were a supreme being dishing out rewards and punishments and could control this whole thing, then we should definitely protest. And, tell the Buddha to do a better job because there's no reason for sentient beings to suffer. But that's not what's happening at all. We are creating our own future by the actions that we do now. And so, this teaching, it also comes back to why Buddhism is a practice or a religion, if you want to call it that, that is one of personal responsibility because we create the causes for what happens to us. Okay, which means that if we want happiness, the responsibility is ours to create the causes, and the power is ours to create the causes. We don't have to propitiate somebody external to us to, rearrange the conditions in our life so that we're okay. What we need to do is create the causes for them. Okay, the second quality of karma is that it's expandable. In other words, a small action can bring a big result. So this is often, the analogy is often given of a small seed or a small cutting can grow into a big tree that bears many fruits. So sometimes you might look at the small thing, like when we planted trees a little while ago. Remember when we got 1,200 trees, they arrived UPS, And they looked like twigs, just these twigs sticking up. Well, from that twig later on can become a huge tree with a lot of different fruits and things going on. So similarly, in terms of our action, a small action has the potential to bring a big result. So this is important to remember because it makes us more alert. For example, when we're tempted to, do something, a harmful action, sometimes ego mind says, well, it's just a little harmful action. It's just a little white lie. It's not so important. And we make up these excuses to ourselves why it's okay to do this. But if we remember that a small action can bring a big result, a big painful result in this case, then we'll have more energy to abstain from that action. Similarly, in terms of positive actions, sometimes we're a little bit lazy to create them. Especially we have the practice of, let's say when we get up in the morning, making 3 prostrations and taking refuge in generating our motivation when we get up in the morning. And we might think, oh, that's just a little positive action, doesn't really matter, I don't need to do it. But if we remember that small actions can bring big results, then we'll really take the opportunity to integrate that positive kind of action and behavior and mentality into our life, because we'll see that it does have a profound effect on our life and lives. The third quality of karma is that if the action has not, if the cause hasn't been created, the result won't be experienced. Okay, in other words, things don't happen accidentally without causes. or randomly. If we haven't created the cause for something to happen, we won't experience the result of that thing happening. And this can be used to explain many things that we see in our lives. And I remember hearing one story that really made a profound imprint on me. In Seattle a number of years ago, there was a big fire in a warehouse, and a number of firefighters went in and were killed in the fire while they were trying to put it out because the floor collapsed. And there was one, squad of firefighters is the right word, but group of firefighters, I think about four of them. They were supposed to go in, they were on their way in to that building that was burning before the floor collapsed. And one of the firefighters, his suspenders broke. Now, how often, if you're a firefighter, do your suspenders break? I mean, come on. It's not the average thing that happens. Because this one guy's suspenders just broke, he couldn't go in, and because he couldn't go in, that small group of firefighters, they all couldn't go in. Those guys didn't die in that fire. And I thought, to me that was like an incredible story. You know, if you haven't created the cause, you don't get the result. Now here the cause, if we look in terms of karma, when people die, an untimely death, like these firefighters did. In other words, when you die before the extent of your lifespan has been lived out, it's generally due to a very heavy negative karma created in previous times. So it ripens as this heavy event that, cuts off one's life prematurely. Yeah. So, but if one hasn't created that cause, then even you're so close to a big accident that could kill you, you don't wind up getting killed in that accident. Okay? Do you get what I'm saying? I mean, it could be some kind of situation. Here I'm just kind of randomly guessing. I have no ability to know. But maybe in a previous life, all these guys were soldiers in an army together, and they were doing an assault, and perhaps this one small, while some of the soldiers went in and were really savage attacking others, another small group of them decided, hey, we don't really believe this, we're not going to do this, and they didn't do that action. Well, it could be that because of that, then in this life, there they are together, but in a different configuration, and the ones who did the savage attack are the ones whose karma ripens by their life getting cut off prematurely, and the ones who decided not to, and even risk court-martial because of it, then the suspenders broke and they didn't go in the burning building. Okay? So it's hard for us to, I'm just guessing here, because it's hard for us to know. We don't have the clairvoyant powers to know exactly who did what, when, that brought about some specific result. But there's lots of stories in the scriptures where the Buddha, was often asked, unusual things happen, and people said to the Buddha, okay, what did these people do in a previous life? And then he would tell these different stories. And if you read the Jataka tales, the stories of the Buddha's, previous births before he became the Bodhisattva and the Buddha, then, you see lots of these kinds of stories of how people meet repeatedly in different lifetimes, but according to how they related in one lifetime, that affects how they, the effects they experience together in another lifetime. Okay, so I think it's quite interesting because, we hear stories of people like on 9/11, people who normally go to work in the World Trade Center, and that day they didn't go to work, or people who usually don't work in the World Trade Center, but that day they had a conference or a symposium and they went there. Yeah? Well, all that kind of stuff happens because of our previous actions. And if results aren't created, then the cause isn't experienced. So, that was an example in terms of experiencing negative results. In terms of experiencing positive ones, it's similar. If we don't create the cause for happiness, we're not going to get happiness. If we don't create the cause to gain the realizations of the path, we're not going to get them. If we don't create the cause for liberation and enlightenment, they're not going to come. Okay? So this is really emphasizing, again, our own responsibility, that it's not up to the Buddha to practice for us or to make us enlightened. We're the ones who have to create the causes for that. So remembering this thing, that if the cause isn't created, the result isn't experienced. You know, if we meditate on this and make a lot of examples in our lives, then we'll, you know, it really helps us to be very, very vigilant about the kinds of causes we create, the kinds of things that we engage in, because we know that if the cause isn't created, the result won't be experienced. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then the fourth quality is of karma is that it doesn't get lost. It doesn't kind of vanish. So our computer files sometimes vanish without our knowing what happened to them, okay? But our karma doesn't vanish. And something that we do in one life can plant seeds in the continuity of our mind, our ever-changing mind, but those seeds may not ripen for many, many lives or eons. It's hard to say, but those seeds don't get lost. They don't kind of fade away with time like our laundry fades when we hang it out in the sun over time. It doesn't happen like that. Now, that doesn't mean that things are faded and predetermined and there's nothing that we can do. Okay? It doesn't mean that, well, because, you know, karma doesn't get erased, that, okay, I did a negative action, well, then, you know, I'm doomed. It doesn't mean that, because there's a lot of flexibility within the system of karma. I mean, karma is cause and effect, so it talks about conditionality. It doesn't talk about predestination and rigid things. So in the case of negative actions, if we counteract our negative actions by purification, then we cut the energy of the negative action. Yeah, in terms of our positive actions, if we oppose, you know, if they get opposed by our getting angry or generating very strong wrong views, that, you know, impinges on the ability of our positive actions to bring their results. Okay, so there is this kind of flexibility. Things aren't doomed or predetermined. So understanding this gives us some energy to do purification practice. Because I don't know about you, but if just looking, forget previous lives, just looking this life, I've created a ton of negative karma. Now that's not going to vanish over time. I have to do something that actually manages to cleanse that from my own mind stream. And so we do that by the four opponent powers, which I'll speak about a little bit later. Yeah. In a similar way, when we do create positive actions, it's important to protect it because our positive actions aren't concrete and they can be affected by other causes and conditions like anger and wrong views. So we want to protect them, you know, so that anger and wrong views don't impinge upon them. And we do that through dedicating the positive potential or the merit and realizing that ourselves as the agent of the karma itself, the action itself, the object we did it, the result that we're going to experience, that all these things are empty of inherent existence. Okay, so dedicating with an understanding of emptiness helps us protect the seeds of our positive karma so they don't get damaged. But I know for me that just even remembering this fourth one, how I can... you know, how if I remember it, it gives me more energy to do purification and to really review my life and clean things up and regret the things that need to be regretted. And it also gives me more energy to pay attention to dedication at the end of, you know, positive actions. And it gives me more motivation to try and avoid getting angry, because when I think of anger as a conditioning factor that interferes, you know, and dampens the effects of my constructive actions, then I don't want it to do it. So that gives more energy to avoid getting angry and hostile. Okay, so those are the four general characteristics of karma. When we meditate on this, or even discuss it, you know, with each other, it's really helpful and I think interesting to make examples from our own lives, from what we hear about, what we read about, because then it can really help us understand the teachings of karma, and it can help us understand our lives and why things happen the way they happen. Okay, because often when somebody gets sick, one of the things that comes up is, why me? You know, why do I have kidney disease? Yeah, why do I have cancer? Why me? Yeah? People ask that a lot, and they feel like victims. You know, the universe isn't treating me right. Why did this happen to me? Well, if we have an understanding of karma, then we understand that things happen due to causes and conditions. Some of the causes and conditions might be this lifetime in terms of diet and activities, but we also have conditioning from prior times, whatever our actions were. And so things aren't without causes. We created the cause. And I think it can be very helpful when we're experiencing some suffering. You know, instead of saying, why me, and rejecting the suffering and saying, this is unfair, the universe should be different, to say, I created these causes, so I'm getting to the result. And if I don't like this result, then I have to be careful not to create the causes that bring it in the future. Okay? So this kind of way of thinking, it's a thought training practice, it can help us avoid getting angry when we experience suffering. Because we see there's no sense blaming anybody outside of ourselves, because we were the ones who engaged in the negative actions. And second of all, it helps us really reflect on our actions and begin to change, because we see that our actions bring results upon ourselves. And if we don't like these results, then we need to clean our act up. Okay, so I think that can be incredibly helpful. I know for myself that way of thinking really helps when, you know, like if I feel like I'm being treated unfairly, instead of saying, oh, they're treating me unfairly, you know. I usually start out doing that and complaining, you know. But then eventually I realize how miserable I am, and, you know, and instead of blaming other people, I have to say, well, I created the cause for this. And, you know, since it's an unhappy result, it was a harmful action I did. And I did that action under the force of my own selfishness, because we don't create negative actions when we're acting for the benefit of others. We create them when there's selfishness. So I have nothing to blame for my suffering, basically, but my own self-centeredness and my own ego-grasping, my own self-grasping. So, you know, I've got to do something about those, and I've got to refrain from harmful actions. And that helps me a lot. And especially in things, you know, like somebody talks badly behind our back, and, you know, and then we feel hurt and we feel angry and blah, blah, blah. Well, then if I look and I say, well, you know, and I feel it's unfair that somebody talks behind my back. But then if I look, you know, and again, just forget about previous lives, even this life, have I ever talk behind anybody else's back? Well, yeah, lots of times. Many times, you know? So, if I've done that, why am I so upset when somebody's talking behind my back? You know? Why do I get so mad at that person for doing this and think it's all unfair, when I've done the very same thing many, many times? It's kind of like, you know, children, you know, look at yourself and clean yourself up and stop blaming others. Okay, so that technique, of that way of thinking is, and understanding karma, can be very helpful in our practice. This thing of saying, why me? We very seldom do it when something good happens, you know? We very seldom have happiness and say, why me? Yeah. I mean, like, we all had food to eat today, didn't we? Do we ever say, why me? Why did I have food today and there's so many starving people in the universe? You know, sometimes we ask that question, but very often we just take our food for granted, or we take our friends for granted, or we take, you know, the buildings we live in for granted. We take, you know, everything we have for granted. And in, you know, the food offering that we do, you know, at the beginning, I contemplate how much positive potential I have accumulated in order to receive this food. You know, that's a reflection on karma, helping us to realize that, you know, even something like one meal comes because of our own positive karma. And so not to take the efforts of other sentient beings for granted, and not to neglect being generous ourselves, because generosity is the cause of receiving. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that we should be generous just in order to receive food. Okay? I mean, we really want to be generous for higher purposes, okay, to benefit others, to attain enlightenment, and so forth. But I think it can be helpful on some level for us to remember that our food does come because we were generous. You know, it comes through the kindness of others who worked very hard, but it also came because of our own karmic action of being generous. And if we remember that, then, you know, when there's an opportunity to be generous, then we'll take that opportunity to be generous instead of being lazy about it. And that's why, you know, I feel that it's important to make offerings and to share things that we have, you know, in a proper way, you know, for the benefit of others and as a way of reminding ourselves that, you know, the happiness we experience doesn't come out of nowhere. And similarly, you know, when we have friendships, because I think friendship is very important to all of us, or harmonious living conditions, you know, to remember that it doesn't come just by accident. It depends on what we do in this life and how we relate to people, but it can also depend on previous lifetimes. And I remember one time, this is very cute, His Holiness Dalai Lama was teaching about karma in Dharamsala, and he was going through the 10 negative actions, and one of them is unwise sexual conduct. And in explaining the result of unwise sexual conduct, one of the results was, you know, you have bad relationships, and your spouses are unfaithful. And, I mean, of course, that's clear that it happens in this life, doesn't it, you know? But when we were walking away from that teaching, one of my friends said, "Now I understand why my marriage didn't work out." You know? In other words, instead of just blaming your husband for what he did, she realized, hey, you know, probably in a future life I had some unwise sexual behavior, and this caused the, you know, the discord in the marriage that led to the separation. Yeah? And so for her that was very helpful, thinking in that way. It was like, okay, you know, gotta clean things up and stop blaming other people. Okay? So when we're thinking and meditating about karma in this way, very helpful to make many examples in our life. And, you know, the question often gets asked, why do, and someday somebody asked it at the talk, you know, why sometimes do good people have unhappiness and, you know, people who are harmful have good results? Okay? Well, there are certain conditioning factors in this life, you know, social systems and stuff like that. But there's also karmic things. And so a person who does a lot of harmful actions this life but experiences some degree of fame or wealth, you know, is consuming the good karma that they created in previous lives, you know, and they're consuming it because they have fame and wealth, but they're also creating a ton of negative karma that's going to lead them to unhappiness in the future. And sometimes when we see very wonderful people experiencing suffering in this life, you know, I mean, yeah, experiencing suffering in this life, well, some of that may be due to diet or external conditions, social systems and so forth, but some of it may also be due to negative actions they did in a previous life. Yeah? And so, you know, this way of understanding can be very helpful. I do not recommend explaining this to people when they are in the middle of grief, when they have no understanding about karma. Okay? This is not a skillful way to introduce karma to people who are grieving, who don't have faith in cause and effect, because they very easily misinterpret it to mean we're blaming the victim and saying they deserve to suffer. You know, we're not blaming the victim and saying somebody deserves to suffer. We're just saying that causes bring results, and results happen because of causes. Okay? Nobody deserves to suffer. Nobody is worthy of suffering. And, you know, as much as possible, we should do what we can to alleviate suffering. Similarly, sometimes you hear people who don't understand karma very well saying, well, you know, somebody's experiencing suffering, and if I try to help them, I'm interfering with their karma. You know, so I should just let them suffer and they purify their karma that way. I think that's a gross misinterpretation of what the Buddha said, and a very big excuse for not being compassionate and not helping. You know, I mean, can you imagine somebody gets hit by a car and they're bleeding in the middle of the road, and you stand over them and go, poor thing, this is the result of your karma. You know, I'm not going to take you to the hospital because then I'm interfering with your karma. I mean, that's a bunch of hogwash. And a person who thinks like that to show the ignorance of karma, they don't realize that at that moment, they're creating a ton of negative karma by having, you know, by being so callous to somebody else who's suffering. Okay? So we're not at all saying stuff like that. And then also, we need to clarify that karma does not mean predestination. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, you never know the future until it happens. So there's a lot of things that can modify karma and can affect how things ripen. And if we look, I mean, cause and effect is such an incredible, complex thing, you know, how they talk about the butterfly in Singapore that flapped its wings and it, you know, changes, it has this ripple effect that goes on and on. Well, you know, how a karma ripens, it depends on, like, so many different things. So sometimes in the scriptures, or sometimes you might hear simplistic explanations of karma saying, you know, okay, if you kill, then you're going to get killed. I mean, like, kind of black and white like that. If you steal, then, you know, your house is going to get broken. The kind of, like, predetermined results and very black and white kind of thinking. And it's not like that at all, you know, because one action can bring many different types of results, and exactly, you know, within each type of result, exactly how and when and where something ripens, it's, you know, mitigated by so many other factors. Yeah. Like I told you on Monday the story of my friend Teresa who was killed, you know, in Bangkok, you know, by this serial murderer. Well, I thought, you know, she had some kind of heavy negative karma to have her life cut off in her early 20s by being killed. But, like, if she had, you know, not gone to this party and not met this guy, it wouldn't have happened. Or even if she met this guy at the party, if she had said, well, I don't like going out alone with guys who I don't know in a strange city, you know, and not gone out with him, that karma wouldn't have had a chance to ripen. Perhaps she could have gotten to Koh Phan, purified it, and then, you know, it wouldn't have ripened. It would have ripened to something much less. Okay? So there's all sorts of different things that affect how something ripens. I think we can notice in lives that when we put ourselves in certain situations, either mental or physical situations, we can see it's much easier for negative karma to ripen. Yeah, we can see. If you go into a situation where there's a lot of violence, you know, if you go into a bar at 2 o'clock at night, it's, you know, you're going to have different karma ripen than if you go into a monastery at 2 o'clock, you know, provided you're not a thief in the monastery. But, you know, the environment we place ourselves in can affect what karma ripens at a certain time. Similarly, what choices we make, what mental attitudes we have, what motivation we have affects what kind of karma ripens at any particular moment and how any particular karma ripens in the whole scheme of things. Okay? So what I'm getting at is, you know, we have to have a really vast, big mind in terms of understanding karma and not see it as a simplistic thing. And that's why, you know, they repeatedly say in the scriptures that only the Buddha has the clairvoyant powers to see, you know, who did exactly what action, when, where, how, with whom, that ripened in this specific thing that happened today. Okay? That, the, you know, only the Buddha can say that. The rest of us are speaking in generalities as a way to help us understand principles. I think it can be helpful, you know, when we're watching television, you know, and the few times if you go through to watch television or go to the movies or when we read the newspaper, it can be an incredible meditation about karma. You know, because you read these incredible things that people do. Yeah, and you start thinking about what are the karmic results of what these people in the news are doing. You know, what kind of result are they going to experience in future lives based on what they're doing now? And if you think about them, it helps generate compassion for people who are so ignorant in that way. And it helps us really think about, you know, the more specifics of cause and effect. I mean, like you think of, you know, like one of the terrorists, you know, on 9/11, you know, premeditatedly, you know, going and you know, trying to kill people. Yeah. Now, what kind of, you know, situation is that person likely to find themselves in the future? You know, now they may die saying for the glory of God or for the glory of whatever it is, but you know, what situation are they really going to find themselves in the future, you know, due to the ignorance and hatred that caused them to do that kind of negative act? And if we think of the suffering that they're going to experience, then it can help us have compassion for them instead of, you know, wanting to retaliate and revenge and, you know, us create more karma to experience bad results too. Yeah. Similarly, sometimes when we read the newspaper and we see the kinds of things that people experience right now and the weird stories that you read about, and then we start to think, well, what kind of karma cause could a person have created to have this happen to them? You know? Like, why in the world would that happen to somebody? You know, they're just kind of walking down the road and then, you know, all of a sudden their life changes dramatically. I mean, we hear stories like that, don't we? Some small thing happens and like the person's life is forever changed. Well, why? You know, again, it's due to previous causes, you know, positive causes, negative causes, whatever. Okay? So it can be very, very helpful as a practical application of these general principles of karma to think of it in terms of what we read in the news. Okay, well, I was going to finish my whole talk on karma today, and I only got through the first section of talking about the general principles. So we'll carry on next time, but I wanted to leave some time for questions and comments and some discussion.
I've always wondered why it is that you read about high status and definite goodness.
Mm-hmm.
They say that, you know, like people, for example, people on the Bodhisattva's path who are engaging in 6 or 10 perfections create the causes for high status, wealth, you know, and to not have hungry and these sort of things. But those are the type of situations that seem to exacerbate the negative qualities of attachment and greed because you're surrounded by wealth and opulence. And those seem like the ideal situations for people to, you know, to gain power, for people to abuse those power to create really ruins karma.
And I've
also heard it said, you know, that you don't want to be really, you really don't want to be born with too much wealth. You want to kind of be somewhere in the middle because it's better, you know, for your mind in that sense.
So, okay. So when they talk about bodhisattvas, you know, as one result of their deeds, experiencing temporal pleasure, you know, wealth or fame or whatever, and wouldn't that create the cause for more defilement to arise in the mind? In the case of a bodhisattva, okay, okay, let's talk about bodhisattvas. This kind of person has generated bodhicitta, so their ultimate aim in their actions is full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. That's what they really care about. The side effect of their actions is that they get wealth and renown. But that their motivation for doing the 10 perfections or 6 perfections isn't to get wealth and renown. That's not their motivation, because that's a very worldly motivation. But those things come as a byproduct, because when you have bodhicitta, if you have some wealth, then you can use it to benefit others. If you have some renown, then people, you know, might come to hear your teachings. Okay? So for a bodhisattva, even if they have those things, in their mind, you know, because they're opposing selfishness, they're not going to use those things to generate defilements. They're going to use those things for the benefit of other sentient beings. Okay? For ordinary people, okay, who aren't aspiring for liberation and enlightenment, but who motivate, you know, well, I'm gonna, you know, offer lunch to the Sangha because then I'll be rich in the future. Yeah. Well, then they may get richness in the future, but because, you know, they have no motivation to really overcome their attachment, that richness in the future could, you know, lead to them becoming more greedy or more selfish or something like that. So I think that's why it's really important that, you know, not just to create positive actions, but to really do them with a good motivation. And even if people are doing something with the intention to experience a worldly result in a future life, like wealth, okay, at least then for them to in their mind say, but when I receive that wealth, I don't want to be attached to it. I want to be, you know, and I don't want the wealth to cause problems. I want to use the wealth in order to help others and to practice. Okay? But people have different levels of how they can practice, and for some people, thinking about liberation and enlightenment, it's just too far away, you know, and all they have a firm belief in future lives, and that's all they want. You know, liberation, oh, that, you know, that's for the monastics. I can't aim for that. You know, I'm just going to think about, you know, having a good rebirth and, you know, this life, I don't have a lot of money, so I'll give Donna some next lifetime. I'll have some money. Okay? Well, it's, you know, it's certainly better than having a negative motivation and being greedy in this lifetime. You know, there is some kind of understanding of karma and some kind of willingness to help. But still, because their motivation is, you know, for their own pleasure, even if it is in a future lifetime, that karma will only ripen in terms of their wealth in that lifetime. And if they haven't done any cultivation to eliminate their anger and attachment, that wealth could lead to a lot of problems, because they could, you know, create negative karma protecting that wealth in a future lifetime, or get very greedy to have more. Okay? So, but for people who have a different mental capacity, you know, at that particular moment of the path, then they may say, well, my ultimate aim is liberation and enlightenment, and, you know, that's my ultimate aim, and I'm doing this action. I want it to ripen like that. You know, in future lives, I will need food, so if it ripens in terms of food, I'm certainly not going to complain, okay? But that's not their chief motivation, and so then there's less likelihood of them having those fortunate worldly circumstances, but then misusing them. Okay? Clear? Yeah.
Can I comment?
Sure.
I feel that I don't quite believe that people get wealth, that some magical law of karma provides wealth, mm-hmm. so that they will be able to do good with it. Seems to me quite natural, however, that if people are generous, kind, spend a lot of time and effort helping other people, so they're really practicing a bodhisattva path, then people are thankful. And when people are thankful, they give things. Mm-hmm. And some give stuff, money, food, clothing. Others, like governments or kings, give status. They can give titles, mm-hmm. or in monastic systems, they create elaborate hierarchical structures. And some people play the power system, but some people are more pure and just are recognized by those systems.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, another way to look at it is that if you're practicing Dharma, starting with generosity, kindness, and all that, then people give you stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things are going to come to some extent. So that's another angle that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also good or important not to take all these things too literally, because those kind of, what you brought up, reflects the social conventions of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see throughout the scriptures, and we see this in Christian stuff as well, and probably other religions, that, or even, you know, like in Lord of the Rings, all the good women are beautiful. That's a stereotype from many societies, that the sign of inner virtue is outer good looks. Well, you know, there's a few prince and the pauper kind of things, mm-hmm. but often you're mm-hmm. a prince, you're a great warrior. So some of that is the literary, what do you call it, literary conventions to make an impression on people. And so sometimes it doesn't have to be taken completely literally.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean that because somebody's wealthy that they're more virtuous.
That's the problem that
yeah.
has happened in many Buddhist countries, where the Buddhist ideal, at least in Nepali, is that a king is a king because of the good karma mm-hmm. done in previous lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then that ripens into something, many things, like mm-hmm. becoming a king. But that was also used to justify tyrants.
Mm-hmm.
who were not good people. They did not keep sila. They killed lots of people. They were one of the reasons Buddhism was wiped out in India, because a lot of the Buddhist kingdoms were filthy, corrupt. So these teachings, if they're misapplied, mm-hmm. can and have been used to legitimize. And it's happened in the West. You're rich because you deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a bastardization of the teachings, but it's happened a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering why it was. The ripening of positive karma was wealth that the greediest, oftentimes the greediest, mm-hmm. most destructive people are
right.
wealthy.
Right. Well, see, that's the thing. In one lifetime, somebody could have created positive karma through being generous, and that results in the wealth. But that doesn't mean that that person has well-developed generosity and kindness, you know, implanted in their mind over many lifetimes, that's going to automatically appear in that lifetime. Okay? It just means that they did, you know, at some point, some action of generosity. But it doesn't mean that their mind has that habit of being generous.
Huh? And so would you say that karma refers mostly to external circumstances? It's almost, you're emphasizing that quite a bit.
Yeah, that's right. I think that actually where karma ripens most is upon the aggregate of feeling, because the aggregate of feeling are the experiences of happiness and suffering that we have. So karma chiefly ripens on that aggregate of feeling. Yeah. You know, I think the external circumstances are given as an example, because some people, when they're born in a situation of poverty, most people, when they're born in a situation of poverty, suffer. Okay? But, and so I think that's an easy way for people to understand. Yeah? But the real way that the karma manifests is on the feeling aggregate of the experience of suffering. And some people can be born poor and not suffer, and it's because, you know, of creating the cause for happiness.
Mm-hmm. Well, one makes you suffer a lot.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, be careful. There's some pretty good evidence, like poverty, as we use the word now, is a relatively recent concept.
Mm-hmm.
And for a situation that I know somewhat is that 50 years ago, Thai farmers who didn't have the concept, the modern concept of poverty.
What's the modern concept versus the old concept?
The modern concept has become a lot about having certain income. You're poor if you don't have a certain income level. You're poor if you don't have the trappings of a modern Western lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Many Thai farmers 50 years ago didn't think of themselves as poor.
Mm.
It was historically, and this has been mapped out, it was after World War II,
mm-hmm.
when Truman was the one who gave the speech, but when his brain trust came up with the concept of development and divided the world into developed and, I'm not sure what they called it then, undeveloped, poor and rich, first, second, third world. And then this was spread throughout the world, and then governments like the Thai government bought into that for a variety of reasons, many of them self-centered. And then the Thai farmers were bombarded with TV images and government propaganda saying they're poor. So then they started to think of themselves as poor, whereas previously they didn't. And often, before that time, poor was more in terms of your virtue. People spoke as much of being poor, or like Jesus, the poverty of the spirit, that's another angle, but poor was as much, you were poor if you didn't have enough to eat and things like that, but you're also poor if you didn't have virtue. And so we have to be real careful looking. Some of our modern concepts were not operative in Buddhist countries 60, 100 years ago.
But aren't those modern concepts still a convention of karma as well? That somehow if that convention creates suffering in someone's mind because they never thought of themselves as poor before, and now all of a sudden they have suffering in their mind because they're thinking of themselves as poor, that also seems to me to be a product of some kind of reckoning. Suffering doesn't come from nowhere.
Well, to me, it's a matter of perception, and one doesn't have to refer to past karma. When one perceives their state of being as being poor, then they create suffering out of that. I don't see that one needs to explain it in terms of past actions ripening.
But where else would suffering come from?
From their misperception.
But where would that? I mean, it seems like it's a...
So the misperception came from government propaganda and they're not being clear enough about causality, and so they buy into the propaganda.
It could be that there's influences of both. There's the government propaganda, but then why some people in that situation may buy into the government propaganda and some people may not. And the people who buy into it suffer. So karma may have some role there in terms of why some people buy into it and why some people don't.
Well, can I clarify?
Uh-huh.
In the Pali, at least, karma is not assumed to be past lives. And karma specifically means action, not the results.
Yes.
I think the meaning has gone back and forth between the specific meaning karma as action, but other times it's being used in the more vague karma, which is what some people call the law of karma.
Mm-hmm.
So I use the word karma to mean action. And so if we go back to the example of a Thai farmer buying into this notion of poverty, yes, there were karmas involved. That farmer had thoughts, that farmer did things, that farmer said things. And I can see a process of causality in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And both the karma, I mean, causality is bigger than karma. So that's another, karma isn't the law of cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
Karma is one
aspect,
manifestation, or the law of karma,
mm-hmm.
or the relationship between karma and vipaka,
mm-hmm.
is one manifestation of the law of conditionality.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the farmer had to make karmas, to buy into it. But then there are other causal factors at work that weren't necessarily that person's karma. Mm-hmm. You could say it was the government's or mm-hmm. Milton Friedman's.
Or the media.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's fine to, I mean, if people want to assume that it was karma in past lives, you can. But I think it's good to also start with examining the karmas that say that farmer could actively remember mm-hmm. from the current life.
I think the whole thing, like I was saying before, it's a very complicated system with causes from many coming from many different directions. And so, yeah, you know, examine what's going on this lifetime. Examine what happened, you know, conditionality from the past. Because even what's going on this lifetime, then you could trace it to, you know, all of Thai history. Yeah, and all of the history of the Western countries, how we got this kind of ideology that, you know, that was then imposed on Thailand. And I mean, when you start looking at it from the viewpoint of cause and effect, it, you know, there's just so much interrelated stuff there.
Well, you just said that kind of, you know, on a personal level, that what our mission here is to see conditioning and karma as two influences that we are trying to be free of. But that's what the teachings are about. These things are sort of imposed on us.
Well, it's not that they're imposed. It's not like there's me and then conditionality is imposed on me. I am conditionality. I don't exist independent of conditionality. Mm-hmm. I exist only because of causes and conditions. You know, without them, I don't exist. Okay? When we're talking about emptiness or nirvana, okay, we're talking about the unconditioned and that realizing that, you know, is liberating. But then when you talk about the actions of a bodhisattva or the actions of a Buddha, you know, or even an arhat, you know, an arhat's compassion or whatever, those are also conditioned factors. Okay? Because all of relative existence is conditioned. Yeah, it's all dependent. So in cyclic existence, what we're conditioned by is karma and klesha, klesha being the afflictions or disturbing attitudes, negative emotions. We want to be free of that kind of conditioning, okay, the conditioning that causes suffering. But, you know, if you're going to be of benefit and service to others, that depends on conditioning too.
And being free of klesha in and of itself involves creating causes.
Right.
Always actually self-causal.
Right. Yeah, we have to create the path, you know, and the path is a conditioned phenomenon, okay? So it's actually an interesting thing. We shouldn't think that, you know, conditionality itself is evil, bad, you know? And sometimes it's presented that way and it's very easy to think, or like to think that impermanence is bad. Impermanence, there's no bad or good. There's no moral thing in it. You know, impermanence just... You know, a Buddha's omniscient mind is impermanent, okay? Because any consciousness is changing moment by moment, yeah? It's eternal, but it changes moment by moment. So we shouldn't think that just conditionality in and of itself or impermanence is in and of itself is something that's evil or, you know, afflicted or suffering. It's true. It's sometimes presented like that. Like, you know, this world is conditionality and nirvana is unconditioned, so we're going to just totally, you know, it's like there's two realms, conditioned and unconditioned, with a brick wall, so let's leave this one and go across the brick wall to that one. But I don't think it's, you know, if we're going to be of service to others, I don't think it's quite like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm.
The risk of laboring this point. I want to come back to this idea of what is a ripening effect and what is something that seems like it's outside of a ripening effect of my personal karma or this might seem karma. Because maybe I'm seeing it too black and white or too fundamental.
Yeah.
I want to know what are those other conditions
that I have. Well, I mean, His Holiness talks a lot. I went and asked him one time, actually, about this. Yeah, because sometimes in Buddhist circles, they say, well, everything is karma. Well, you know, it is, you know, the fact is the thunderstorm karma. It's a thunderstorm due to karma. No, it's the pleasure that a sentient being experiences due to the breeze. Okay? It's the feelings of happiness or pleasure that we experience due to those that are the result of karma. But the thing, the physical thing itself isn't necessarily due to karma. Like, you know, if, I mean, this is a silly example, but it serves the purpose. If, you know, you're standing under an apple tree and an apple falls on your head and goes clunk, okay, the apple doesn't fall because of karma. It's not karma that makes the apple fall. But while you're standing under it and experience the suffering of a headache after that, that's due to karma. Okay, why did you happen to be there at that very specific moment when the apple fell? And why, you know, is your head hurt? You know, maybe somebody else has a hard head, they don't get hurt.
So could we extrapolate and say the people in the World Trade Center building just happened to be there?
No, but why did they happen to be there? It's their own actions that got them there.
Mm-hmm. They took jobs there.
Mm-hmm.
It's maybe not cool to say this, but some of them were incredibly greedy people because they were working in a very greedy, many of them, you know, stock traders and bond traders and stuff like that. You know, they chose to take jobs there. Some probably competed very hard to get some of them because they're high-paying, high-profile jobs, some of them.
Well, like, why did the World Trade Center collapse? Because steel, when melted and encountering fire, that's what happens on a physical level. You know, what happens to steel is not karma, it's physical causality. Okay? So the World Trade Center collapsed simply, you know, a physicist tells you why it collapsed, and they're investigating
how
to build
it. How it collapsed.
Okay. It got gone. Okay. But then the question of why were those specific people in that building at that time and experiencing suffering? Mm-hmm. And why were some of us outside that building? We didn't get killed, but we experienced a different kind of suffering. Okay. So within that one event, you know, there's people experiencing all different sorts of things in that. You know, and that's because of individual actions that they've all done. And not one simple action that everybody's done, but probably multiple actions.
Earlier you said this why me
mm-hmm.
question, and that's why I came in. Ajahn Buddhadasa felt that the Buddha's teaching was about how suffering happens
mm-hmm.
and how to get free of suffering. But human beings have the habit of asking why, which is often why me or why not me, like when we're not getting what we want. And that, I think, leads to a lot of confusion about these kind of things. The broader teaching for all these things is conditionality. Things happen through causes and conditions. That's a more fundamental teaching of the Buddha than karma. So when people jump in and try to explain everything by karma, they're getting ahead of themselves, and it's a kind of sloppy way of thinking. The starting point is to see it in terms of causality, and then within the causality, there are causes that involve human intention.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of those you can see more collectively, some you can see what other people did, but the emphasis, because karma is about how we get ourselves involved in suffering, is to look at our own actions and how we got ourselves involved in suffering. So I think it's really, we need to be careful about looking at other people's actions in terms of karma, because it can easily become flippant or judgmental. You gave some examples.
Mm-hmm.
So we might say generally that the people in the World Trade Center, their karma got them there or something. But there's no point in sort of trying to pick that apart very far, because then we end up just blaming or something. The whole point with all the teachings is to come back to ourselves and why am I still creating suffering? mm-hmm. because I'm doing things, and I'm doing them with intention, and that means I'm doing them egoistically.
Or, like in terms of, the World Trade Center, now we have such a perfect example. Every time something happens, we use it. But it's true, because, we often say, well, why did this happen, or how did this happen, or whatever it is. But what karma are we creating now? What conditionality are we setting in motion now by the way we react to what happened to the World Trade Center? Okay? So often we space out on that. Yeah. And our government policy, I think, is a space out on that. But karmically also, in terms of, beyond this lifetime, what result, the causes for what kind of results we create, we often space out on that and seeing that, there's an event that happens that's conditioned, but our reaction to that event is more conditioning and more karma created. And sometimes we're so focused on figuring out why that we don't look at what our present action is. Am I explaining this well enough? Are you getting it? Yeah?
Do you plan on, next week, not now, of course, but talking about karmic vision? Because I remember I asked you about it once, and you gave it was towards the end of the teaching, and you gave a very short sort of answer. I've always been very interested in digging into that more.
I could have a little bit. I can't say it's 100% clear for me, but I can maybe give you some of my guesses about what I mean about karmic, what they mean about karmic vision. Yeah. Remind me next time, okay? Okay, let's do a little bit of meditation.